Before I start this evening, I'd like to do a sound check. I'd like to ask you to raise your hand if you cannot hear me. Oh. Okay. Okay. So there's maybe a tiny bit louder. Yeah. Okay, so please raise your hand if you cannot hear me, if you still cannot hear me. Okay. So my voice may drop at times. And if that happens during the talk, I would like, please let me know that you cannot hear me, and we'll try to increase the volume if that's the case. But it seems like everyone can hear me now. Great. Thank you. Thank you. Good evening again, dear friends. It's said that the Buddha's teachings and practices went against the stream. And that was the case in many different ways. There were many spiritual currents at the time of the Buddha. And they had this same aspiration of reaching a liberation, awakening, but they all claimed that that could be achieved by some kind of self-mortification, ascetic practices, and the Buddha tried them all. Until he came to the realization that that was not the path. One day, when he was feeling very discouraged from all the ascetic practices he had been doing, starving, eating only one grain of rice a day, a memory came to him of when he was a child sitting under a tree and feeling very contented. And he said, quite secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful mental qualities, I entered and remained in the first jhana. Could that be the path to awakening? Then, following on that memory, came the realization, that is the path to awakening. So he decided to try that path. First, he ate some rice and porridge, and feeling satisfied, he sat down and he accessed that state that he remembered from his childhood. And then he went on from there to achieve full enlightenment that same night, so the story goes, but not without obstacles in the form of the devilish Mara. The hindrances assaulted the Buddha until he reached full awakening. So this was a turning point for the Buddha, which made it possible for him to reach awakening. It started with nourishing the body, making the body comfortable, and that made his mind contented. So then, the understanding arose from those conditions, the understanding into the Four Noble Truths and dependent origination. Released, I discerned that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done, there is nothing further for this world. So the Buddha had discovered through his own experience what we know also from our own experience and also scientifically very well, that human beings have a survival instinct to gravitate towards that which is pleasant and to avoid, to shy away from that which is unpleasant. For example, when we put the hand on a fire, we take it immediately away because it burns and we would get injured. And that's the case for the people that have leprosy, they don't have that sense, and so they get many injuries. In the same way, we like sweets because sugar has a sign of energy to keep us alive. So he used this knowledge to his advantage. He realized that if we learn to delight in the pleasantness of the wholesome and skillful qualities and actions, those that lead to our welfare, to our freedom from stress, and to feel the pain of the unpleasantness of the unskillful, we will naturally want to develop that which is wholesome. And for that, we need to notice. We need to notice the pleasantness of gratitude, the pleasantness of appreciation, the pleasantness of keeping the precepts, of our own generosity, of metta, of wishing well. And in order to let go, in order to let go of a sensual pleasure, which won't give lasting satisfaction, we need to have another pleasure, unworthy pleasure, which somehow replaces that sensual pleasure. So then the path can be summarized in a few words as a gradual abandoning of increasingly subtler levels of stress caused by clinging, and as a result, the tasting and dwelling in subtler levels of happiness until reaching final liberation, Nibbana. So we have these two aspects of the path: the uprooting of the unwholesome and the cultivation of the wholesome, the skillful. And the Buddha had many lists of wholesome qualities to be developed. I'd like to read to you a poem from one of the early enlightened nuns from the time of the Buddha. And these nuns came from a wide variety of backgrounds when they came to ordination. They could be young, old, rich, poor, mothers, grandmothers, queens, princesses, orphans, wives. So this is the nun Genta. And it seems from this poem that she could have been a bit of a striver. I was forever getting lost, until one day the Buddha told me, to walk this path, you'll need 7 friends: mindfulness, curiosity, courage, joy, calm, stillness, and perspective. For many years, these friends and I have traveled together, sometimes wandering in circles, sometimes taking the long way around. There were days when I thought I couldn't go on, There were days when I thought I was finally beaten. It's scary to give all of yourself to just one thing. What if you don't make it? Oh, my heart, you don't have to go it alone. Train yourself to train just a little more gently. Train yourself to train just a little more gently. Tonight, I'd like to speak about these friends on the path, the seven factors of awakening. Sati, mindfulness. Dhammavichaya, investigation of the Dhamma. Virya, energy. Piti, rapture. Pasadi, calm. Samadhi, concentration. Upekkha, equanimity. In the fourth foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of Dhammas, there are only two lists of qualities that the Buddha offered as frames for meditation, the hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. So this is the Buddha. These seven factors of awakening, kasapa, are well expounded by me and are cultivated and fully developed by me. They conduce to perfect understanding, to full realization, and to nibbana. Monks develop the path and practice leading to the end of craving. Which path, which practice, leading to the end of craving? The seven factors of awakening. Before going into these factors of awakening and how we might practice them, I guess there might be some questions arising in our minds. There are many accounts from the time of the Buddha, from his disciples reaching full liberation, awakening. Sometimes even crowds, whole crowds of monks all becoming enlightened just from hearing one teaching of the Buddha. And we might ask, but is that possible now that the Buddha is no longer around? And last night, a guy inspired us with accounts of great enlightened beings of our time. But is this possible for us? And the Buddha said, yes, that is possible if we practice these factors of awakening. But what is awakening, we might ask? The Buddha's promise is full liberation from suffering. But we have a sense. Do we have a sense of what that might mean? And what does that mean for you? What is awakening for you? What do you want? And what you want now might be different from what you wanted when you first came to the practice. That was certainly the case for me, as I shared with you in our first night together. So what is our relationship to awakening? All of these questions are very important, because how we conceive of awakening and what's possible for us will greatly influence how we practice and the fruits of our practice. So I would like to suggest to keep these questions alive, both in our practice and in our lives. So all of you have already been experiencing these factors. But becoming more aware of them, we can grow them it's important to begin to see them, to recognize them, to dwell in them. Because what we pay attention to, that grows. So the first one is mindfulness. Mindfulness is this overarching quality. I call it the umbrella quality that supports the development of all the other factors. Without mindfulness, the factors cannot grow. And Guy spoke at length about mindfulness, and he mentioned the quality of understanding, sampajanya, that accompanies mindfulness. It's about knowing what's happening, knowing our experience directly, within this overall context of knowing what's helpful and what's unhelpful. So in simple terms, this means viewing experience in terms of cause and effect. For example, when we become aware of the presence or absence of the hindrances, of a strong desire, for example, for some food that we don't have here on retreat, there is mindfulness, and we understand in being in touch with that felt sense of wanting, we understand that this is not helpful. So what supports mindfulness is what we pay attention to and how. We become aware of our actions, of body, speech, and mind, with the goal of developing these factors of awakening rather than just being lost in thought and planning our next holiday or what we're going to do when we finish this retreat. And when we are mindful, we start to become interested in what's happening. And the next factor of investigation comes to life. Investigation, Dhamma Vichaya. This is a kind of discernment, interested in what's skillful, what's happiness-inducing, and what isn't. A close quality to this is that of appropriate attention, yoniso manasikara, which is said to feed all factors of awakening, is paying attention to what starves the hindrances, what feeds these factors. Appropriate attention to understand. And what can be helpful is hearing about what's skillful, what's unskillful, but most importantly, being close to our experience, to the effects in ourselves. That's why we need mindfulness, to feel our experience very closely. As we sit and we're planning to get a second serving, and we feel that pull, and we feel how that is creating some tension in the body. So there is that felt sense, that direct experiencing. And this is also the capacity to ask questions of practice. And virya, which is the next factor of energy, is the effort of applying the answers to the development of the factors. We could also call it courage, virya, courage. And courage is a heart quality. Courage is a word in English that comes from the French cœur, heart. heart, to mean heart. And Virya in Pali also means hero. So we can think about this quality as heroic effort, persistence, perseverance. When I think of heroic effort, courage, and perseverance, I often think of Nelson Mandela, who labored for the liberation of his people from the oppression of apartheid regime in South Africa. He was in prison for about 27 years, a lot of the time in solitary confinement, and yet he did not give up. When he came out later, he became the president of South Africa and he continued to labor for that freedom. And he said this: as I walked out the door towards the gate that would lead to my freedom, I knew if I didn't leave my bitterness and hatred behind, I'd still be in prison. So this is courage. This is Virya. And I haven't met him in person, but I saw him pass many times by car on the streets of Maputo. And my uncle that met him in person and other people that met him told me that he has great joy. He always has a smile to the people that he meets. So this courage gives rise to joy. It gives rise to joy. So it's important to find a sustainable way of applying energy in our practice as we develop these factors, as we develop the path. And what might be helpful in finding that sustainability is in having a view of practice as a lifetime project. So having a bigger view. So we don't get discouraged by a moment of distraction, by a particular hindrance attack. So we've all been persevering, demonstrating the willingness to keep engaging, keep practicing, engaging with what shows up in our practice. And the more we practice, the more we can relate to meditation as an art, as a skill that we are developing. Recognizing and appreciating our own courage and perseverance is very important. Even more important than what we might perceive as results. Because that appreciation will be a condition for piti, joy, to arise. So piti, this next factor, is usually translated as rapture. And that can be a good translation in some contexts, but I really like this translation of joy, delight that comes from taking interest. It is really a result of the energy that we put in. But it can also be cultivated. And some of the ways in which this is cultivated, and this has been shared by several of the teachers, notably by Sally's, in the ways in which we relate to our object, for example, the breath. How Ajahn Brahm uses the image of the beautiful breath or the perception of the beautiful breath, falling in love with the breath. Ajahn Lee Damodaro, that Guy spoke about this morning, he also uses Budo to accompany the breath, with each in-breath, Bu, with each out-breath, Do. And Budo means awakened one, so if we have a connection with this word, awakening, then this inspires devotion, inspires joy. There is a time when the great master Ajahn Sumedho, when he was practicing with Ajahn Chah, his practice wasn't going very well on a particular day, and he went to him and he shared what was happening, and Ajahn Chah said to him, "Just reflect on your sila." And Ajahn Sumedho went back to his kuti and was all worried. What have I done? What have I done wrong? My God. And then he realized, oh, actually, what Ajahn Chah is pointing to is that because I am keeping the precepts, because I make a point in having impeccable sila, then reflecting on that, appreciating that, that gives rise to joy. And joy will then give rise to calm and concentration. So he was relieved. And joy can also arise from noticing the absence of the hindrances. This is illustrated very well by the similes used in the suttas. When the Buddha speaks about someone that is freed from each of the hindrances, one of them is, for example, that of a person that has been suffering for a long time with a very serious illness, and suddenly, or maybe not so suddenly, is cured and finds health again. And we can imagine, wow, what a relief, and how much joy can there be for someone that finds finally freedom from illness. So taking delight, noticing when the hindrances are absent and taking delight is another way to nourish joy. And we can also nourish joy through gratitude and appreciation. These are qualities that may not get much attention in our mainstream cultures these days, gratitude and appreciation. There was a famous Jewish rabbi who lived in America in the 20th century, Abraham Heschel, and he said, "As civilization advances, the sense of wonder almost necessarily declines. Humankind will not perish for want of information, but only for want of appreciation." Only for want of appreciation. David Orr, who is an American environmentalist, or environmental educator, he said, "Gratitude is the single most important quality needed to address climate change." He said, "That's what's missing. Only in such a spirit can we be freed from the loveless illusion of independence and discover the sustaining truth of interdependence." So gratitude and appreciation, hugely important for the development of joy. And this is a joy that can be cultivated in our own minds that is less dependent on things being exactly as we wish them to be. And one person that comes to mind very often when I think of joy is the Dalai Lama. I never met him actually in person, but I get a sense of his joy from the stories I hear, from the pictures. And one that stuck with me was when he was once giving a talk, a public talk, to a large audience, maybe hundreds, and he made a mistake. He said something that was a mistake. And when he realized that, he said, "Oh, I made a mistake, ha, 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 ha," and he just broke out in laughter. And I remember that very often, that joy, "Ah, a mistake." So these are the people that express joy. These are the people I tend to gravitate towards. There's also the practice of metta that we have been cultivating here, a great source of joy, seeing what's good in ourselves, seeing what's good in others. And noticing that joy when it arises, noticing it, how it manifests in the body, and dwelling in those manifestations will allow us to harness that sense of well-being. And we can use that sense of well-being to soothe the body and the mind. And as one is being nourished by this inner sense of satisfaction, we don't look for pleasure so much outside. So the body and mind become tranquil. And this is the factor of calm, pasadi. I also call it serenity. Although it may seem that calm is a quality not so valued in our culture, it turns out that it may not be so. One of the things about long trips like the one I did to come here is that I get to read magazines and watch movies on the plane and documentaries. And I read this article in the Harvard Business Review magazine, which described a study conducted by MIT where investors and entrepreneurs were first asked what they considered important when evaluating a pitch for an investment opportunity. Both said that it was the passion shown by the entrepreneur that was determining. Then the investors were asked to watch the videos of pitches, but without sound. So they couldn't hear the words, they could only see the facial expressions and the gestures. And the result of this study was surprising for both of them. The quality that revealed essential for the projects they were that were chosen for investment, the quality was calm. Investors were more likely to associate calm with leadership. So calm, we usually are so used to intensity, the intensity of the hindrances, the intensity of emotions, that when this factor when the hindrances subside and this factor becomes present, we don't notice it normally, and we get bored. I remember when I first came across this quality of calm, I was on retreat at IMS for 3 months, And I came to see Guy, and I said, nothing is happening. Nothing. There's nothing. And he said, oh, that seems like that's calm. And that was true. By recognizing it, we can begin to find it and appreciate it. And that was the case for me. And as we become familiar with it, it brings a lot of contentment in the mind. We notice that it is satisfying, and it is an acquired taste. So I'd like to invite us briefly to an experiment right now as we're sitting here, and we don't need to close our eyes, but we might just take a few moments to tune in and feel if there is any sense of calm right now present for you. Might be felt on the chest, in the belly. So it just takes a few moments of turning towards a quality to begin to notice it. And a big part of what we do in meditation is to develop sensitivity and subtlety of the attention, so we begin to notice more subtle qualities of the mind, like calm and concentration. As we let the mind rest there in calm, samadhi, concentration, develops and grows. And as I develop sensitivity to the light and my talk, I see that I don't have light to read. So I'll just... Okay, this is better. Can you hear me well? Anyone cannot hear me? Okay. So, chan chan, samadhi. Samadhi. So, this is how the Buddha spoke about samadhi. A monk endowed with these six qualities could break through the Himalayas, king of the mountains, to say nothing of miserable ignorance. Which six? There is the case where a monk is skilled in the attainment of concentration, in the maintenance of concentration, in the exit from concentration, in the preparedness for concentration, in the range of concentration, and in the application of concentration. A monk or a practitioner endowed with these six qualities could break through the Himalayas, king of mountains, to say nothing of miserable ignorance. So that says something about samadhi. He really encouraged the development of samadhi to his disciples. Develop concentration. A concentrated mind discerns things as they have come to be. Discerns the Four Noble Truths. So, Guy already spoke about this quality in his talk last night. how we might define samadhi, and concentration may not be a very good translation of samadhi. So there is this way of defining it is as singleness of mind, unification of mind. And although right samadhi can be translated in a different way, there is generally agreement in the suttas, in the Pali suttas, that the jhanas are mentioned countless times. From the night of the Buddha's awakening all the way to his death. He encouraged his disciples and to practice jhanas. So samadhi can also be seen as these four levels of jhana, meditative absorptions. When devoid of unskillful qualities, when devoid of the hindrances. So this is from Tanisaro Bhikkhu. The singleness of jhana means not only that awareness is focused on a single object, but also that the object is reduced to a single quality that fills the entirety of one's awareness, at the same time that one's awareness broadens to suffuse the entire object. This mutual pervasion of awareness and object in a state of expansion is what's meant by absorption. However, I have found that only in the third and fourth jhana, in my own experience, there is this singleness of quality, a single quality. So there is this sense of connection, the sense of intimacy with the object of attention. First the breath within the body, or the sense of metta also felt within the body. And then as we progress through the jhanas, it's the intimacy with the prominent qualities of each jhana. And there's several similes, and Susie shared some of those beautiful similes that are used to describe each of the jhanas. And they illustrate the various levels by repeatedly mentioning these words of expansion, suffusion, stretching, and filling. So there is this sense of expansion and making single, but that's not making narrow. So how do we develop this? The first step, several discourses in the Pali Canon describe that the first step in samadhi and concentration practice is the abandonment of the five hindrances. This is key. It is key to acknowledge when they're present, that they are unbeneficial, and in that way we'll be motivated to abandon them. So after a big hindrance attack, we call hindrance attacks when all of the hindrances are there at the same time. We have desire and aversion, and at the same time we're feeling sleepy and restless and have doubts, everything. That's usually called a hindrance attack. Once that's abandoned, there's less hindrances, there's less and less than just one as they subside. So we gain mastery of each jhana before moving on to the next. this is not a jhana race. There is a lot to be gained from each jhana, from dwelling and mastering each jhana. And as we move from one jhana to the next, this means we're releasing subtler and subtler levels of contraction, of tension, of clinging. And it's not a linear process. We don't go just one to the other. And if anyone would come through the door and report to me a steady, unhindered ascent into the heavens, I would say that person is not practicing. And the practice of walking meditation. So whenever we can, the teachers, I don't know if you've noticed that, we put in a plug-in for walking meditation. And so this is my plug-in. These are the five rewards for one who practices walking meditation. Which five? They can endure traveling by foot. They can endure exertion. Become free from disease. Whatever they've eaten and drunk, chewed and savored, becomes well digested. The concentration he wins while doing walking meditation lasts for a long time. And the Buddha also speaks about sometimes some types of wrong concentration, wrong samadhi. And he says, one of his disciples says, what sort of jhana or samadhi did he not praise? There is the case where a certain person dwells with his awareness overcome by sensual passion, obsessed with sensual passion, making that sensual passion the focal point. He absorbs himself with it, besorbs, resorbs, and supersorbs himself with it. So this is wrong jhana. And in retreats, we have this phenomenon called the Vipassana romance. Everything about someone you fixated on seems endearing. The way they walk, the way they take off their shoes, the way they fold their meditation blanket. Next thing we know, we're planning the honeymoon. And many years ago, one time when I was meditating at Chuen Min in Burma, where there's monks and nuns and lay people that come to stay and meditate for various durations, and all lay men and women and nuns are required to be covered up completely in clothes. But monks are allowed to have a naked arm and shoulder. So I became fixated in a monk's arm and shoulder. I was absorbed in that sight. The thought of that arm and shoulder, the image, whether I was walking or sitting, I was totally absorbed in arm and shoulder. So when sexual desire arises in samadhi practice, it's important to work with it in skillful ways. The energy normally gets concentrated around one area, which might be the genital area, and the mind lost in fantasy. So it's important to encourage that energy to flow and circulate through the whole body. we can really use it to in our favor, because this energy can be quite similar to the energy of piti. So we can use it to support our practice, which is what we're here to do. And by attending to this energy, we disengage from the thinking process and from the fantasies. So really, really helpful. So the practice of samadhi plays a very important function in our path. The delight that we feel with samadhi enables the mind to stay and become stable, which is needed to gain insight. And this practice also encourages the development of sensitivity as we become aware of increasingly subtle levels of pleasure. We can also notice subtler levels of stress that we can release. And because these pleasures are so exquisite, we also lose interest in sensual pleasures. They become less attracted. The pleasure of jhana is also a place of rest and resourcing for us on the path. And this is so important for us on the path and in our lives. Practicing samadhi, as you will have noticed by now, also teaches us a lot about how to relate with practicing a skill, about our relationship to goals, to making mistakes. If you ever had to learn a language or how to play a musical instrument, you would have faced that kind of learning. And the more we practice samadhi, the more we realize that it only depends on conditions. It has nothing to do with the self. We cannot congratulate the self for this or that result, and neither can we blame the self. So no one, I'm sorry to say, can take jhana trophies back home. And there, no one can fail either. So the measuring mind drops away, and it gives rise to more ease, to more love, to more compassion, the falling away of blame, of judgment towards ourselves, towards others. Finally, there is another aspect of the practice of samadhi that is remarkable for our path and for our lives. With each jhana, there is a particular quality that is predominant. And as we dwell in it, absorb in it, and sustain it, it becomes the lens through which we perceive experience, through which we perceive the world. This may be the reason why jhanas are sometimes called perception attainments. For example, for the second jhana, that predominant quality is sukha, happiness. And as we practice the mastery of this level of jhana, we expand the senses of and ranges of happiness that are available to our being, and we see the world through happiness, and that transforms our lives. Really, there is no point in practicing jhana if it doesn't transform us and how we see the world, how we see ourselves. And we begin to understand that the world, what we call reality, is not independent of how we see it, of how we perceive it. And the solidity of the world drops away, and it gives space for other senses of world to emerge. This is again from Abraham Heschel. The search for reason ends at the known. On the immense expanse beyond it, only the sense of the ineffable can glide. It alone knows the route to that which is remote from experience and understanding. Neither of them is amphibious. Reason cannot go beyond the shore, and the sense of the ineffable is out of place where we measure, where we weigh. We do not leave the shore of the known in search of adventure or suspense, or because of the failure of reason to answer our questions. We sail because our mind is like a fantastic seashell. And when applying our ear to its lips, we hear a perpetual murmur from the waves beyond the shore. So the Buddha considered concentration to be essential to the path of awakening. Concentration leads to insight and to a mind that discerns. When the mind is calm and concentrated, equanimity, the seventh factor of awakening, comes to light, which is also the predominant quality of the fourth jhana. Equanimity. And equanimity is an attitude of even-mindedness in the face of every sort of experience, regardless of whether pleasure and pain are present or not. This quality of equanimity is the last in various lists in the Buddha's discourses. So we can see it as a culmination of development. And equanimity is not indifference, it's not detached, it's connected, it has metta, compassion, joy. When I walk out of this hole and I take this center line, I look at the statue of Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion, and what I see in that posture is equanimity. Kuan Yin, she who hears the cries of the world. And equanimity is such a valuable quality in our lives. It really supports us to face all the vicissitudes of life. Things don't always go the way we wish them to go. And this is the quality that allows us to navigate those circumstances and find peace. So there is a shift, a beautiful shift that happens with the practice of these factors, from a mind that is stuck in hindrances to a mind that is waking up. And even if we don't want awakening, if we practice these seven factors, that's where we are heading. it's inevitable. There is this simile of the chicken and eggs that the Buddha uses, that if a chicken sits on its eggs and gives warm and incubates them, even though it might occur to her, "Oh, my chicks will not come out," if she has been sitting there and giving them warmth, they will come out. They will break the shells. They will come out. So in the same way, if we're practicing these factors, that's where we're heading, even if we don't think we are. I would like to end with this small text from a podcast from Vivek Murthy, 21st Surgeon General of the United States. "All of us, regardless of what walk of life we're in, we have the ability to shine a light on the bright spots, whether those are relationships that bring joy or movements in our community that are helping grow connection. It's where we choose to focus our attention. It's where we use our power to focus the attention of others that ultimately determines whether or not we create more light in the world or more darkness." Let us sit together for a few moments and let the words drop. We have about 25 minutes for walking meditation, and we'll be back at 9 for some chanting.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.